This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to John Lanchester's Capital and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook. A 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than a well-trained Cocker Spaniel to fetch the morning newspaper. Okay, so I am here with John Lanchester, who is most recently the author of Capital. John, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
First off, you didn't have to send me all those postcards to get this interview, just to be clear. I just want to...
How do you know it was from me?
Well, we have our investigators. We have a very devoted research team who tracked it down to you. You know, you and your townhouse next to Karl Marx, so, you know...
You might have other sinister semi-stalkers around there.
I see. Well, maybe perhaps. I don't know. I don't know how far our audience reaches sometimes. But to go to the We Want What You Have campaign, the Washington Post's Ron Charles made a comparison that also struck me, that the postcard harassment in this book is not unlike the anonymous phone calls in Muriel Spark's Memento Mori. So I'm wondering, because this is such a pivotal narrative element upon which the book rests, where did this come from? I mean, you know, I'm guessing this book was a little early before the London riots. So, you know, was it Spark? Were you the recipient of too much junk mail? How did this exactly happen?
No, I was thinking about, I love that book, by the way. And, if there is a literary reference, that's a good one.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about the fact you get, and I don't know whether this is a London thing, a UK thing, a big city thing, or a thing about modernity, or maybe a thing just about some cities as opposed to others. But the sense that people living in very close geographical and physical proximity don't actually know each other at all. They don't know anything about each other's lives. They have nothing in common. And, you know, the term much beloved of politicians, community,
yes,
is actually a cant term, I think. It really describes something that people pretend exists, but a lot of the time doesn't. Communities in geographical sense, in my experience of living in cities, just simply don't exist. It's certainly true in my experience of London life. And I wanted to have something a novel that had the sense of these sort of parallel private lives that barely touch.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have something that forced them into contact with each other and sort of gathered up these strands of these different lives. And the idea of these postcards came from thinking about what people actually in the street have in common.
Yeah.
And in a sense, the main thing they have in common is that they live in a place other people want to live.
It's rather ironic in light of the fact that, well, here in the United States, we're seeing our postal service decline, and it will get to the point where, what we get in the post is probably, we're not going to get much, if anything at all. So I think you kind of reached that possible maximum window of what can unite a community. But this does beg the question of, well, can you in fact use a plot device like this to unite a community composed? You have a Muslim family in this. You have a soccer player. You have a Polish plumber type. And I'm curious as to, you know, whether communities really are united around something along lines of a plot device, or if it takes a plot device now for us to consider the great cosmos of Pepys Road in this, or London, or anything right now. What, you know, can the novel unite community in a way that, say, other forms cannot?
I think one of the basic movements you get in a story, well, in stories in general, is that thing of strands being gathered together. And I think that sense of these things that seem to be disparate that actually do have a cohesion, that's a very kind of fundamental underlying dynamic of lots of stories. And it's also a kind of story I really like.
Yeah.
Like that feeling of gathering together. I mean, there is, I suppose there's a melancholy undercurrent to the thought that without, you know, without those cards, these people actually don't really know each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, without an effort of sort of will and imagination, I think a lot of the time, in fact, we don't know each other. And I did sort of want that sense of the way in which they know each other to feel slightly fragile, because actually it would be very easy for it not to happen, you know. And that, as I said, that's quite close to my experience of the city, that there is this this thing about our immensely close physical proximity being sort of shadowed by the fact that actually we don't want to know too much about each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of knowing about one another, I actually wanted to ask you, because the feeling I got when reading this book was that often a chapter would spring forth from another chapter, that a particular character, such as Parker, would then get his own little hotel room chapter, and that sometimes that narrative tension produced a desire or curiosity or a need to explore another angle of this vast community that you're exploring. I know that you planned much of Capital in advance, but I'm wondering to what degree you strayed from the map that you laid down when writing this novel. If you drift away from your map in the act of writing and revising, do you need to go back and modify the floor plan? How does this work for you?
Well, you're right. I did spend a lot of time thinking about what I sort of described to myself as the architecture of it, you know, the structures of the story and who goes what when. My memory is that I had, it's the equivalent of index cards.
Mm-hmm.
I say the equivalent because it was actually a software program called Scrivener. I write in longhand, but I've been using Scrivener. I've never used a computer program to write a novel before, but Scrivener was very helpful because of this index card thing that I could then move around, you know, the chapters or the scenes to, and I kept sort of running through that rhythm of what, when.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had it pretty thoroughly mapped, but only, I think, the kind of very granular level of, you know, exactly what, say, for the first quarter or third. And then once I'd got through that, the chapters further ahead did keep sort of changing order as I was coming closer to them, in order to have that sense of, oh, actually, no, I'm going to need that bit there just because, you know, to change the tone, or it's been too long since we last had so-and-so, so we need her back now. And there was a lot of juggling and a lot of jiggling and a lot of swapping A with B and C with D and X with Y, but not very much kind of going outside the framework of it, because but mind you, it was a pretty accommodating framework, you know, that there was quite a lot of room for the characters inside it. But I didn't I think in terms of sort of genuine things that were, in the E.M. Forster thing about, you know, characters escaping, that didn't really happen. But I've always rather liked Vladimir Nabokov's reply to that, you know, Forster's books were so boring, you couldn't blame his characters for wanting to escape. And I always think both parts of that, you know, that the structure is pretty determined in my books, but the things that the characters do and say within that structure, I find constantly surprising. I find both halves of that to be the case.
The question I have, though, is if a character is going to act in a certain way or behave in a certain way that is in defiance of the plan, and it's interesting you use A, B, C, D in this, because in the course of the book, we often get these little ABCs of the character mind and so forth. Do you have a situation where you lose the thread of a character because the character's going to act in a particular way when you're laying it down on the page? And the other question I had, sort of related to this, is, well, we do know that you wrote a book called IOU, Whoops, in the UK. And if you are writing in some sense in response to the 2008 economic meltdown, and if you are to some degree enslaved by newspaper headlines, what does that do to you from a novelist standpoint to really corral this, what I would presume to be a tightly enmeshed plan that if you stray from, well, it causes more time, more difficulties, and so forth?
Well, it was the other way around, because I started writing the book in 2005, early 2006.
Yes.
And I felt certain that there was a bust coming.
Uh-huh.
I mean, certain enough to bet years on writing the book that had it. And it was very important that right from the start, the reader knows something that the characters don't.
Yeah.
You know, that the reader can see this thing coming that they're all oblivious of. And partly I was just very interested in obliviousness. That was, and I had a very strong sense that there was this kind of implosion or meltdown and things had got out of hand. And so I started writing the book with that kind of shape in mind. And if there hadn't been a crash, I'd have, I mean, it would almost be the other way around. If there hadn't been a crash, I really would be in trouble because the whole arc, you know, the novel does, I hate the word arc because it's become such a cliche, but it does have a sort of trajectory. And that just was built into its, to use that word again, architecture. And I really don't know what I would have done. But because I was following it, And then this meltdown happened. And in fact, you know, I can't pretend I had any sense of that that's what it would be, or that it would be so global and so systemic. I thought it was just like a local bubble, you know,
yeah.
kind of property bubble of a type that, you know, I'd seen before, even in my own life. And then it turned out to be this global systemic proper crisis. And so I finished a draft of the book, and I thought that because I'd been interested in the reality in parallel with the fiction, I couldn't pretend that I'd, you know, seen it coming in that the way it did. And I always put a draft of a book aside for a few months just to wait, to kind of see it clear before it, to allow myself to see it clearly, to make certain sorts of editorial choice. And I thought, what the hell, you know, I'll use the few months to, I always promise myself I'm going to do something constructive with that time, you know, take up Pilates or something.
Yeah.
Never do anything. I often promise myself I'll write a screenplay, which I've managed never to do. And this time I thought, what the hell, I will actually use it, and I'll take a few months and write a non-fiction thing about what actually did happen.
Mm-hmm.
With two ends in mind. One, because I was really interested and I wanted to sort of explain it to myself and to the reader. And secondly, also, I thought that it would, in rewriting the book, because I only go forwards when I'm writing, I start at the beginning and go forwards. I thought in rewriting and revising and editing the book, I would be tempted to put more of the explanation and the kind of journalistic specifics of the credit crunch in.
Yeah.
And that the writing IOU would have a kind of quarantining effect, that I could put the detail and the specifics and in a sense my own views about, you know, what should be done in the nonfiction thing, and go back and keep the fiction kind of clean and intact.
Yeah. I'm curious about this explicative mode. The book actually, at the very beginning, it reminded me very much of the way Booth Tarkington would describe the way the world was, or at least as he saw it. It was obviously problematic because he was racist and all that, but that's another issue. But you laid down this world about how these houses were constructed. But at the same time, when you're talking about explaining things in a novel, when you're talking about novels about money, this gets into complicated terms because you have to describe economic phenomena, and that's not always translatable into character action. I'm curious how you wrestled with this problem. You know, a number of writers have attempted to do it. There's a great need right now because people want to understand the economic crisis in fiction, and you know, you can't always do it through explanation. I know you also work as a journalist. So how does the novel offer a solution for this? Do you feel that there are things that you regret not doing with Capital that that you could have perhaps more seamlessly blended in with these characters and so forth? Is this also one of the reasons why we often read the book and suddenly we see a situation, if this character knew what he was thinking? There's a lot of that going on in your book. So how do you combat the explanatory mode?
I did it by leaving it out.
Yeah.
In terms of the finance stuff, because in my firm view, it just can't be done. You know, and the thing about the credit crunch and IOU is that the story is the explanation.
Mm-hmm.
The explanation is the narrative. And you cannot do that in fiction, I don't think. Or if you can, I've not seen it done. With very, very detailed, complicated, systematic or systemic, that's the other crucial thing. It's not, you know, it's not a thing where you can just name the guilty man. This is a structural and systematic story. And I just don't think it can be done. And I think that explanation of the necessary complexity and length just basically breaks fiction.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, you can do anything in fiction. Characters change gender, you know, travel to outer space, you know, all die off. You know, you can do almost anything, but I don't think you can explain.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a thing they have in science fiction, in SF, there's a device they call Tell Me, Professor.
Yeah.
Where one character says, Tell Me, Professor, what do you, and then the professor replies. And, you know, I was very keen to avoid Tell Me, Professor, in the finance stuff, just because I think it would have, you know, it would break the book.
So if you can't explain economic phenomena within a novel, and you have, as this book did, a built-in hype machine for readers who want to read, well, this is the big economic novel. This is going to tell us how it is. What about an audience expectation? Are you almost setting yourself up for a kind of built-in expectation that you as a novelist or any skilled novelist is not going to be able to live up to this? I mean, was this ever in your mind during the course of writing this, that there would be a demand for explanation that the novel you were writing was incapable of providing?
It never occurred to me that that's what readers would be turning to the book for. I mean, I had already written, by the time I'd gone back to finish the book, I'd already written a book-length explanation. And so my itch was fairly thoroughly scratched, speaking, you know, from my own point of view. I think one of the things that having written about it in nonfiction helps with is that it starts making you think about what fiction and nonfiction do, and what the different, you know, what you can do in one and you can't do in the other. And one of the particular things is that fiction has to feel true.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the single most important thing that has to happen in a work of fiction. The reader has to believe it, has to feel true. Nonfiction just has to be true. It doesn't have to feel true, it just has to be true. And lots of things that happen in life don't feel true, it's just that they actually happen. And another way of describing that is to say that nonfiction is much better at unlikeliness, whereas unlikeliness breaks stories. You know, you can have kinds of coincidence and improbability that the reader just gives up on it.
Yeah.
But those things happen all the time. And so the thing that I was in my mind about this was that the novel should really be, I mean, I say this as if it was an intention. It's actually, in some respects, it's clear after having written it that, you know, you get this funny thing in the world of money, which I didn't know about before, and I do now by virtue of having written these books. When I say no, it's like William Goldman. Nobody knows anything about money. It's like movies. That there are things that are always true, and yet the story changes every time. So, you know, bubbles and busts, that they're all the same. Basically, they're all the same. Tulip bubble to dot-com crash to credit crunch to South Sea bubble. To the 29 stock market crash, all the same story. And yet the details and specifics are very, very different in ways that are very interesting. And I suppose that what I now think is that, you know, you can, in nonfiction, what you can do, what I try to do is write about the things that are specific and different and strange and the kind of particular mistakes that were made this time. Whereas fiction, you can describe the things that are permanently the case. And in this instance, I think some of the most important of those are about people not knowing when enough is enough, people having no kind of built-in sense of enough or break. And also, I think particularly this thing about obliviousness, that you can have these things happening that are, you know, it's a thing that I think in history we're always most severely judged for the things that are right in front of our face that we just won't see.
Yeah.
And I was very interested in that sense of obliviousness, and that in fact we're all living too high on the hog. This thing was coming, you know, towards us. The light at the end of the tunnel was a train coming the other way. And if we thought about it for 5 seconds, we'd have known that. But we chose not to. And the strange thing is that that's always true.
Mm-hmm. Did it occur to you in seeking this truth with your novel to read other financial novels or other money novels? And I'm not sure if you saw Christian Lorenzen did an article in book form recently in which he was discussing some of the problems of the money novel. And he mentioned that this quasi-journalistic explanation was, of course, an indelible component. And even like Adam Hazlitt's Union Atlantic also has to fall prey to this to some degree, or there has to be some sort of fiction that's invented to explain. And I'm wondering to what degree were you aware of other money novels, and whether it's entirely possible to shake off the need to explain and so forth.
Well, I'm a pretty omnivorous reader. But if I know something is kind of closely adjacent to what I'm doing, I won't read it, just because it's more like the metaphor I use is it's like tuning in a radio. You know, you're trying to pick up your own particular frequency, and it just makes it harder to tune the radio in and to be sure you're getting your own frequency. So I haven't read any of those. I mean, I'm not saying I won't, because I almost certainly will. I'm not saying that my settled view on this point is always right for everyone for all time, but I know for myself, I resolved the question pretty satisfactorily that I just thought and think that there are things that you just cannot do within a dramatic and narrative form, you know, to the necessary degree of complexity. I just I don't think it can be done. And it's not only, by the way, money isn't unique, you know, that if you to talk to lawyers about the way legal things are represented on TV, you know, most of them can't watch them.
Yeah.
Because the oversimplifications and the dramatizations are so grotesque. They
Police
can't watch
as well.
Them. But cops can't bear any of that. And lawyers too, you know. Doctors.
Yeah.
You know.
Writers too.
Well, exactly.
I mean, Californication is just a complete fantasy. It couldn't possibly happen in the real world.
Yes. It's such a shame.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, all sorts of things. You know, I played, when I was a kid, I was quite good at chess, played quite a lot of chess. I mean, the way chess is depicted.
Yeah.
It's just grotesque, you know. They do it like it's, you know, like ultimate fighting. Yeah, you know, the speed of it. So, it's not only money. There's these jobs are irreducibly complex, I think, in ways that makes it very difficult to dramatize the fine grain of the detail of what they do, which doesn't mean that the kind of principle, I mean, it's like the money stuff, the principles are actually very clear. I mean, legislating to control use of derivatives is, you know, as complex as the derivatives themselves, some of which have, you know, literally billions of lines of computer code built into them. But the principles are clear. And at that level, you can write about it, I think.
So you're telling me that when you write any fiction, it's an inevitability that there is no way that you could ever get everything absolutely right, and that if an expert is reading your book, they're going to nitpick the hell out of it. When did you come to terms with this as a way of accepting this and carrying forth? Or is this something you accept?
I'm not saying that at all. Yeah. And it's different from getting things right is different from deciding you, as it were, can't go to that specific level of detail. I think the kind of larger scale drama, the impact on people's lives and the psychology and things like that, you can write about. It's just the actual technical, specific nitty gritty of it's partly because I know enough from that now to know about what they do.
Sure.
So, there's a reason there are people with former rocket scientists with physics PhDs designing the instruments. That is the kind of thing they do. And, the thing about not understanding it, and this actually you could probably put in a novel, is that firstly, there's a whole category of these things where they're called black box instruments, where the whole point is that no one knows what's in it. The guy selling it doesn't know what's in it. The guy buying it doesn't know what's in it. He's just told, you know, it's a synthetic thing and it yields that. You know, the yield will be so-and-so and the probability is so-and-so, you in or you out. And they literally don't know what's inside it. Now, to someone a couple of degrees removed, that's Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
Like, thing you are... You know, it is, in buying a pig in a poke, that used to be a joke or a metaphor, but that actually is what they're trading for hundreds of billions of dollars and things like that. And you very often had spoken to people who work for these institutions who didn't know, you know. And so I think you can have if the directors of banks cannot know, I think the writer and the reader can not go into that level of detail too. Because, you know, God knows, the people who work there didn't.
How much, though, do you have to get right? I mean, John Banville has said repeatedly that when he first started off as a novelist, he would, you know, research the hell out of Copernicus. And then eventually he said, you know, this is just a waste of time because he's spending so much of his time dwelling upon the sentence and getting those, like, couple hundred words each day, if he's lucky. So how does this work for you? You're a guy who is curious about everything, it seems to me. And so what do you do to kind of, you know, cut yourself off at the bar of curiosity?
I've never really thought that way. I mean, I tell you when I thought about it a lot, in the novel I read about Hong Kong, which is where I grew up, my father grew up too, and I hit this thing with you know, things that are well known in history and characters who were around at the time, and I tried to work out a rule for what you could make up and what you couldn't. And eventually came up with what I called the kind of building and the furniture, so that the building was kind of known historical events, if someone, you know, as it were, public occasions, things that were on the record. But things that, and so very high profile public figures were sort of the building. And then the furniture was everything else, things that people said in private, the kind of population of characters in the novel. They could do or say anything I liked. And I just found that a useful distinction, that there are sort of things that are set, and to answer your question, that those are the things I suppose you'd have to get right and know enough about. And then within that, I think you have to allow yourself, you know, the freedom to do what you like. And I also think that different novels generate in a sort of subtle and complicated way that I think readers are quite quick to intuit. They generate their own rules about what's accurate and what isn't, and you can tell quite quickly sort of what the principles are. I quite like a reasonably clear-cut distinction between what's factually grounded and what's made up, certainly in historical stuff. But that may be a fault in mine. But I think I find books that completely blend, you know, he was born in such and such, and then a completely made-up story. I start to find it distracting because I start wondering to know which is which. So I do err a bit on the side of, you know, if it looks like a fact in the book, I'd quite like it to be a fact.
I see. I also wanted to ask you, because like in describing Zbigniew's carnal attraction to Davina, you write, the mechanism simply worked perfectly and repeatedly every time. It was considered purely as sex, the best sex of his life, and so forth. Quite a lot of adverbs, actually, there. And this leads me to ask you, you know, about your sentences. There seems to be something about them that almost invites these adverbs in. And I'm wondering, you know, a lot of novelists, are, especially here in America, are down on adverbs. Do you feel that the adverb gets a bad rap? Does this come from your wide reading experience? Are you just fascinated in capturing some of that 19th century mode? What of this?
I can't say I think about it much from the outside. I try and write the way, I mean, that's tend to be a, it's Zbigniew's way of looking at things I'm describing. So I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the character's world, the character's point of view is often a bit too strong, but they're sort of, as a term, but they're sort of mental landscape. And I don't, you know, think about the sentences from the outside in quite that way. I mean, I do notice there's a sort of, these things go in waves. And I think that there's a sense in which the sort of creative writing as a taught thing has made American writing converge a little bit more. I mean, there's more stuff, is more, things are more like each other than was once the case. And I think that's partly because, you know, telling someone to go through and take out the adverbs is an easy thing to do because, as someone once said, to write simply is always to seem to write well.
Yeah.
I think, and I do sometimes wonder when I don't get it when I, you know, we get this thing in the in the UK that you get here, because only, you know, the top 10% of writing crosses the Atlantic in either direction. We have a slightly misleading picture of how good everything is. But when I read a kind of bunch, you know, I spend some time over here and read a bunch of things chosen more or less at random from the bookstore. I slightly wonder about that. I get a feeling that a lot of youngish writers have been given quite similar advice.
So you're saying that the 10% of American novels that hit your neck of the woods, that you're detecting a conformity? Is this
No. It's the other. It's when you don't get the filter, and you, as it were, see what, you know, the kind of what's coming out before that selection process. And that's where I see what I think perhaps is to do with, you know, MFAs and, and a kind of, and the things that it's easy to teach. It's easy to teach, take the others out. It's easy to teach, write what you know. You know, and it's easy to teach a certain kind of, whimsy's the wrong word, but a kind of...
quirkiness?
Well, as if someone I know judged a thing and had to read a whole load of particular generations. And he, and his view was that the sort of negative influence on the generation of writers he's seen was Wes Anderson, which made me do a double take. I think, but as you say, quirkiness or that, or whimsy, or, you know...
Self-conscious quirkiness, a kind of striving to be different that actually gets in the way of one's natural voice, whether it happens to be naturally quirky or naturally realist.
Yes, and with... I mean, I agree with all of that, but and also with the thing of a kind of omnidirectional irony, a kind of ungrounded, unlocated, not pointing towards any particular point, irony.
Yeah,
and I I do wonder if there is actually a causal thing linking all those things.
Yeah, so irony is really the thing that's in trouble right now.
Well, I think, you know, in the particular sense of say Capital, there's a classic dramatic irony in the sense of the start, because we know this thing that's coming that they don't. That's irony in the strong sense that the audience knows something that the people being depicted don't. I think that, and I know there's a bit of a contest about irony in literary culture here.
Yeah.
And I think I'd agree with the people who argue that. That a kind of, as I say, omnidirectional, permanently attached sort of irony switch, permanently centred on, is a very isn't a particularly helpful thing. I think if you're trying to write from a point of view, you know, about things that are actually happen in the world.
Are you saying that it's more of a generational thing, along the lines of what David Foster Wallace was writing about years ago with E Unibus Plurum, his essay where he was calling for a new sincerity, and then he kind of never really got a chance to kind of write a novel to back that up entirely? That
I do think that, and I think he's a very interesting case, because his sense of complexity and multiplicity and the difficulty of saying simple things was a very, very profound and rooted thing. And it's very easy to just take the ironic attitude from it without the immense amount of psychic and intellectual work that's gone into it. And
yeah.
I mean, I slightly think that's what looks as if it's happened.
Sure. To go back to Capital, I actually wanted to point out something that the Wall Street Journal's Sam Sachs pointed out. With the Banksy-like Smitty, who we haven't actually mentioned, we never actually see him creating any art. He's right to a certain degree, because we know more, for example, about Roger's white noise generator than, why he has been entrusted to his financial position. Although, you know, we get the backstory about how he got there. You have the people who we probably see the work most in this. There's Quintina, the meter maid. There's a big name off the laborer. The business with the passwords near the end of the book. So, you know, I'm curious also that, you know, Shahid, who is lazy, he declines this offer to study physics at Cambridge. Well, he's almost punished by you, the author, for, you know, actually being indolent about his life. I'm curious about, you know, this interesting fixation on who you decide to depict working and who you don't decide to depict working, and how you balance this throughout the course of the book.
Well, what I'd say about that is I've noticed an odd thing in responses to the book, that the more things you put in a book, the more people notice the stuff you've left out.
Yeah.
So I honestly never for a second thought about who I was depicting working and who I wasn't. There's lots of Roger at work, but he doesn't spend all that much time actually working.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it. I mean, I suppose the one thing I would say, lots of working lives are quite difficult to depict. You know, it's difficult to talk about what people do in front of trading screens.
Yeah.
You know, in a dramatic, you can sort of give it a paragraph to describe what they're actually doing, but that thing of kind of carrying forth a narrative across it is difficult, going back to the thing we were talking about earlier about certain sorts of complexity. So I didn't think about that. I mean, I didn't think of Shahid as being punished for his laziness. I just thought he has, in my mind, he had that thing of he's still thinks of himself as he's thinking of himself as a young man a bit too long.
Yeah.
And as you know, the world is full of potential and opportunity. A bit past the point where that was a pint of milk in the fridge, it would have gone off by now.
Sure. All this has me wondering, you know, did you make efforts to get that dramatic narrative momentum by trying to depict, say, characters in front of screens or grappling with financial models and so forth? What did you throw out? I'm curious, too. I mean, were there any characters who were larger in previous drafts who didn't contribute to the vast whole? What was the methodology there? I'm curious.
I did. Well, let me think. There are a couple of characters I chucked out. And
Alan, was there more of him, I suppose? Or?
No, not much. No, there was another household in the street who weren't sort of adding anything. But no, you know, finishing the book was more when I went back after writing IOU, and then that came out, and then I went back to finish it. And it was more a question of sort of cleaning up and, you know, as it were, pointing and emphasising things that were there. There wasn't an enormous amount of change of personnel, mainly because the things were quite closely linked.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, things that went with other things, that sort of exactly was the way it was. I didn't... and maybe there was I think there was a bit more, Smitty's more there in a kind of rounded way than he was in the draft. But apart from that, no, it's pretty similar. And, you know, the other thing, as I say, it was almost the most important thing was almost this negative thing about not having people looking out the window and explaining credit default swaps to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you need to have a large novel to go back to the beginning, to come to terms with this community? Why couldn't you do it with, say, like, you know, either fewer characters or perhaps 300, 350 pages? I'm just curious why you needed that expansive length for this.
Well, need is a loaded word. You know, no book needs to be written in the abstract sense. I wrote it that way because I wanted to. And that was just the way the story sort of felt. You know, you can get sort of, books can be too short as well as too long. I know it's much more rare than for them to be too short. But sometimes if you have a kind of sense of a world and a populated world, it just takes a certain amount of space to get in all the things you wanted to get in. I mean, if I could have got everything I wanted to get in shorter, I would have written it shorter, but this is just how long it took.
Are there certain ambitious efforts with this book that you feel you could have done better with? I'm just curious. Anything that, you know, any character who didn't come across nearly as rounded as you had hoped? Any strand that you thought might have actually been improved? Do you feel that you had enough time with this, or are you pretty satisfied with it?
One of the odd effects of having had this quite big gap in the middle, I mean, when I went back, it was as if it was someone else's book.
Yeah.
To an extent that I've never felt before. I've always had a gap, but I've never had a gap quite like that. And apart from anything else, it's also, you know, I lied to myself, I'll write it in a few months and it'll be done. Of course, it just doesn't work like that at all, because the whole publication process, editing publication, very distracting, and it took up a lot of headspace. So when I went back, it was as if it was someone else's book. And that was very, it was a bit disconcerting, but it was very helpful in, as it were, seeing things clearly, because it was slightly like looking at someone else's novel. It's exactly the book I intended to write. And that doesn't make any claims for it being better or worse, but it is exactly as intended. And more than anything else I've ever written, I think, I wouldn't change a comma in it, partly because it feels as if it was, by the time I went back, it was like editing someone else's piece of work and getting it the way, getting it in finished form.
Exactly as intended? All novels that you write tend to be exactly as intended, because a lot of writers...
No. I've never had that sensation quite as strongly. And in terms of my other books, you know, by the time I got to the point of, you know, they were, there's a sort of psychic flow going on all the time when you're working on it. And I basically think, I think it was Valerie who said, a poem is never finished, only abandoned. And I felt that about my previous three novels, and also I think really about my memoir I wrote about my parents.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel that about this because of the gap. I mean, I did feel that I finished this one.
Well, on that note, John, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay. Photo, skyscrapers shine the sun so low in the sky. The secretary's at the hot dog vendors. Cabs honk at the bicycle messengers. Rolling by.